Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, May 12, 2017. President Kiir calls on South Sudanese to stay calm amid rumors that former SPLA chief General Malong might mount a rebellion.
Yesterday when I talked to him last, he was not in a good mood. He was in a fighting mood. I tried to calm him down, but he was rather wild.
And aid workers renew their calls for authorities in Juba to find gunmen who killed humanitarian workers.
Humanitarians are part of the solution. Humanitarians should be protected and they should be endeared. They must never be targeted, and taking their lives is strictly off limits.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But we first go to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where an Ebola outbreak is reported in the Baswali province. There are 9 suspected cases and 3 deaths reported. One of the cases has been confirmed to be Ebola. The Basule province is close to the South Sudanese border areas of Ezo, Tombora, and Yambio. DRC Minister of Public Health, Dr. Olinga Kalenge, reported the outbreak to the WHO organization. WHO says the first teams of epidemiologists, biologists, as well as water hygiene and sanitation experts are expected to arrive in the area today or tomorrow. The epicenter of the Ebola outbreak is reported to be about 130 kilometers from Buta province, capital of Busele. It is located near the border with Central African Republic. Last time an Ebola outbreak was reported in the DRC was in August of 2014. The biggest ever Ebola outbreak, more than 11,000 people died from the disease in 6 countries, mostly in Guinea and Liberia, between 2014 and 2016. President Salva Kiir says he spoke to former SPLA chief, General Paul Malong, on Thursday. Mr. Kiir says Malong was in what he calls fighting mood. The president is appealing to South Sudanese to remain calm, saying there will be no outbreak of violence. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
President Kiir called a press conference today to speak publicly for the first time since firing Malong. Mr. Kiir faulted Malong for leaving Juba before he could officially swear in his successor, General James Ajongo. Mr. Kiir insists changes in army leadership are normal and says he is mystified as to why Malong would be angered by his replacement.
I did not talk to him this morning. I tried but didn't know. I found that he was resting because yesterday his blood pressure shot up very high. Because yesterday when I talked to him last, he was not in a good mood. He was in a fighting mood. I tried to calm him down, but he was rather wild.
Mr. Kiir tried to tamp down fears that Malong was planning to rebel against the government.
The security situation remains normal, and all citizens are urged to continue with their daily routine duties, because there is really nothing that the new people should worry about. I also encourage you also to stop incitement and inciting fear through the spread of unfounded rumors.
General Malong left Juba shortly after President Kiir sacked him as Army Chief of General Staff Tuesday night and replaced him with General James Ajongo. There have been unconfirmed reports that General Malong was heading to his hometown of Awil to set up a military base and possibly stage a rebellion against the government. Awil residents expressed fear there could be clashes between government forces and those allied to the general. Many fled to rural areas for fear that violence would break out. Malong and his soldiers ended their journey in the Eastern Lakes State capital, Yirol, after local officials convinced him not to proceed to Awil in the former northern Baragazali state. Yesterday, Juba officials sent a plane to transport General Malong back to Juba, but the general declined the ride and sought guarantees for his security before returning to Juba. Eastern Lakes State Governor Bor Wachut Bor told VOA yesterday that Malong is not being detained and was his guest at his state residence. Mr. Kiir says his government will ensure that Malong and the army officers with him are safe.
Personally, I am still in communication with General Paul Malong, and I have assured him of his safety as soon as he arrived in to Juba, and I have given the security organizations all the necessary orders to make sure that General Paul Malong and his people following him are saved, whether we are here in Juba or in any area where they are now in.
Mr. Kiir says community leaders are also talking with the former SPLA chief of general staff to dissuade him from resorting to violence.
The people from Urul who were in Juba here were at the airport looking for a flight to fly to Urul to meet him there. There are other community leaders coming from Awil, his home area, to come and meet and talk to him. There are also people from Gourial estate that are coming to meet him. So it is a concern of everybody, and nobody would want General Paul Malong to run into such unplanned problems.
President Kiir says he expects Malong to return to the capital today, but it's not clear whether General Malong will accept the president's offer. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Aid officials are calling again on South Sudanese authorities to apprehend the killers of humanitarian workers. The UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan says 84 aid workers have been killed in South Sudan while in the line of duty since the outbreak of the violence in 2013. Aid officials and workers held a prayer service today to remember their departed colleagues. Waki Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
Memorial service for the slain eight workers was held today at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Juba, which was organized by international and national non-governmental organizations operating in South Sudan. Pio Ding, who works with the group Finnish Aid, says although eight workers are grieving the loss of their friends and co-workers, the event was meant to celebrate the good work performed by their departed colleagues in South Sudan.
We are here to remember and memorize the outstanding personal qualities of these beautiful and loyal souls. By remembering the best of these people, by recalling some of their finest qualities, by honoring the humanitarian principles, values, and dreams which guided their lives.
Eight agencies help save the lives of tens of thousands of South Sudanese who have no medical care, shelter, or food. Eugene Owusu, the UN Chief Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan, says a majority of the 84 aid workers killed were delivering food, medicine, or tents to desperate people.
Humanitarians are not the problem in this country. Humanitarians are part of the solution. Humanitarians should be protected and they should be endeared. They must never be targeted, and taking their lives is strictly off limits. Humanitarians are sacrosanct, just as are women, girls and boys, the elderly, the infirm, and the innocent. All, everybody should be spared from the wrath of this cycle of violence.
Ding called on authorities to apprehend the aid workers' killers.
The authorities must be seen not to spare any effort to investigate and hold accountable the perpetrators of these heinous crimes, so we can have justice for our colleagues that we have lost.
Gunnar Holm, the Norwegian ambassador to South Sudan, says despite the tragic loss of their colleagues, aid workers will remain in South Sudan.
We will stay engaged in the humanitarian sector, providing humanitarian assistance wherever we can, but also stay engaged in the political process of trying to find, to do what we can do, to find a peaceful solution to the conflict.
Paul Dell, acting chairperson of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, admits aid agencies face enormous challenges, but says the government can only facilitate the work of agencies in areas it controls.
We will only do this if we coordinate our operations. Let's share information. Tell us what you want to do, where do you want to do it, when do you want to do it. It is our responsibility to make sure that what you want to do at that particular time, in that particular area, you will do it without any restrictions from the government side.
Dell says his commission is training its staff to better coordinate the work of eight agencies in order to expedite their important work in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Coons says he saw the devastation caused by the political and humanitarian crisis facing South Sudan. The Delaware lawmaker, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says the United States is uniquely positioned to use its leverage on South Sudan's leaders while at the same time create more efficient and robust ways to deliver aid. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Millions of South Sudanese civilians have left their homes in search of safety, while famine has been declared in two parts of the country, and aid agencies warn it could spread to other areas if immediate action is not taken. After visiting South Sudan's Unity State and Uganda's Bidibidi refugee camp with Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee in April, Senator Coons told an audience at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington yesterday that U.S. diplomats and lawmakers must come up with a comprehensive peace plan to urge South Sudan's leaders to end the conflict.
We have to find a way towards a meaningful peace process in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir can and should be a part of that process, but so far he has failed to show the leadership we would expect of a president. The United States, I believe, will step up and provide further pressure. Regional heads of state need to be engaged, the AU and the UN as well. If neither of these leaders are willing to take the leadership role that the people of South Sudan deserve, then we may need to find alternative paths to peace.
Coons is a co-sponsor of the Food for Peace Reform Act, a bill that, if passed into law, would eliminate regulations that require food aid to be grown in the United States, then shipped overseas to places like South Sudan. Coons says that process normally takes weeks, if not months. By adding reforms to the current Food for Peace program, Coons says the U.S. could save about $500 million a year and reach up to 8 million more people far more quickly than under the current regulations. Coons also wants the U.S. State Department to appoint a special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, a position that has been vacant since January. Isaac Gung, who is the SPLM in opposition representative to the U.S., agrees a special envoy could help bring the warring parties to the table.
What we want to see now with the, you know, with the trip of Senator Coons and Corker is more administration involvement. Trump administration has been a bit a bit slow in moving forward with the selection of a new envoy and clearly engaging the political, the different parties to come to the table.
As the conflict has spread to previously peaceful regions in South Sudan, thousands of citizens continue to flee the country. South Sudanese citizen Char Paul, who now lives in the U.S. East Coast state of Virginia, has grown weary of failed international efforts to stop the fighting in her country.
I think the U.S., they do need to hold the leader of South Sudan accountable for what is going on. It is nice that they're helping out financially, giving aid, but just giving money, taxpayer money, it's not good enough.
Brian Adeba, a South Sudan analyst with the Enough Project based in Washington, says groups like the African Union and the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, which is responsible for overseeing the peace agreement, needs to step up.
When you look at the regional organizations that are involved in this peace agreement and its collapse, they're missing in action. They're also bedeviled with fractions among themselves, and so U.S. leadership is essential. The U.S. has a lot of tools and leverage that it can utilize to bring the parties in the conflict to the negotiating table, and I think it's about time that that is used.
The Enough Project has urged the U.S. government to utilize anti-money laundering laws through the Justice Department against corrupt South Sudanese officials and military leaders. Over 3.5 million South Sudanese have been forced to flee their homes, including more than 2 million people who are internally displaced. The UN Refugee Agency has asked for $781 million to meet the growing needs of displaced populations in the region. Of that, only 11% has been funded so far. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at Sudan's new cabinet and what it can do to end fighting in the country. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important value that your parents taught you?
They taught me to respect everyone. This makes me to live well with any person.
How to live together with people and how to prepare myself for the future. For example, I was taught how to cook by my grandmother. So I stayed with my grandmother and he taught me how to cook. So it has helped me because I don't always stay with my family. So that's the most important value my parents have taught me.
Being someone who might be honest in my life, even in our daily life. It's very important anyway, because in these days, many people may not be honest because of their interests.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Sudan has formed a new national consensus government. Sudan's first vice president and prime minister, Bakri Hassan Saleh, announced last night that 31 national ministries and 42 state ministries will be sworn in as members of the country's cabinet. But analysts say the new cabinet is too large and is not likely to address the economic problems facing the country or stop the war in Darfur, Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Mr. Saleh announced the government reshuffle at a news conference last night in the presidential palace in Khartoum. The current ministers of defense, foreign affairs, health and information will stay on. New ministers were appointed to head the interior, finance and petroleum ministries. Khartoum-based analyst Ismail Ibrahim says, "The cabinet is too large to get anything done and will be a huge drain on taxpayer money."
Our expectation was just a small, efficient cabinet composed of not more than 15 or about maximum 20.
Ibrahim says the new government is tasked with fulfilling recommendations put forward by various political parties over the past 2 years during the national dialogue.
New cabinet supposed to put into practice the results, you know, of the national dialogue, put into action and to make a drastic change.
Above all, Ibrahim says, the new government must bring peace to Sudan.
The most important agenda, you know, for this new cabinet or new government to put an end to all types of armed conflict, whether in Blue Nile or in Nuba Mountains or in Darfur. And not only that, just to persuade the rebels, you know, to join, to come to some sort of a final settlement.
Haj Hamad, executive director of the Social and Human Development Consultative Group in Khartoum, says things are not likely to change with the new cabinet, even though there is a new prime minister, Bakri Saleh. He says President Omar al-Bashir still holds too much power.
They say the first deputy of the president, then they say prime minister. So protocol-wise, in the language of the official hierarchy, he comes first as the deputy of the president.
Hamad says the government is still pursuing policies that will plunge the country deeper into war and economic hardship. The newly appointed ministers are expected to be sworn in tonight. The new government is expected to write a new constitution based on the recommendations gathered during the national dialogue, which include achieving political stability, improving the economy, and guaranteeing civil freedoms in the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Uganda's government is calling on international assistance as refugees continue to flood into the country from South Sudan, straining already impoverished communities. Aid agencies are struggling to keep up with the health needs of the refugees, with malaria being the top concern. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more with additional reporting from Halima Athumani in Kampala.
Uganda, a country known for its progressive refugee policy, is hosting more than 1.2 million refugees and asylum seekers, with about 920,000 of them from South Sudan. Uganda's Prime Minister, Ruhukana Rugunda, says his country has been receiving an average of about 2,000 refugees per day for the last 6 months.
The above numbers are placing a huge strain on our already stressed ability to cater for the food, water, sanitation, health, and educational needs of the refugees and their host communities.
So next month, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and the UN's Refugee Agency are hosting the Solidarity Summit on Refugees, with the aim of securing $2 billion per year for the next 4 years to help meet the funding gap. And as the refugees pour into Uganda, they bring a host of medical needs, further highlighting the need for additional resources. Dr. Martina Fuchs is the CEO and founder of Real Medicine Foundation, the humanitarian aid and development organization tasked with providing much of the health care in Uganda's Bidi Bidi, now the largest refugee settlement in Africa. The settlement hosts more than 272,000 South Sudanese refugees.
The largest disease burden is malaria, a very large percentage, especially in children. And then also pregnant women with malaria. So malaria is the highest. And then gastrointestinal tract infections, diarrhea, watery diarrhea. Then respiratory tract infections, pneumonia. And then in smaller amounts, HIV/AIDS.
According to RMF, malaria rates in children and adults arriving at medical facilities range from 65% to 80%, fluctuating upon whether it is the dry or rainy season. Fuchs says that severe and moderate acute malnutrition is another problem, adding that refugees are also dealing with mental health issues as a result of the trauma they have experienced.
There is research that trauma actually lowers your defense, your immune system. So any kind of emotional, psychological trauma will interfere with your immune system. So you're more vulnerable when you're traumatized than if you're not.
Rosa Malongo, UN Resident Coordinator and the UN Development Program's Resident Representative for Uganda, says that in addition to catering to the refugee population, Uganda's host communities must not be overlooked either.
It is imperative to note that these 12 districts have some of the country's highest levels of poverty and the lowest levels of human development indicators. If we want to help ensure and maintain the asylum space in Uganda, the voices and contributions of these communities must be supported.
By the end of 2017, authorities estimate that an additional 400,000 refugees and asylum seekers will have arrived in Uganda. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Still on refugee issues, South Sudanese refugees at the Pagirinya camp in Uganda's Adjumani district say the more than three-year-long conflict has disrupted efforts to develop and preserve their cultural heritage. Community leaders say the youth do not participate in traditional songs and dances during occasions. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Adjumani district in northern Uganda.
Refugees from Imatong State's Pagiri County say most of their people fled their villages after renewed violence in July, leaving behind cultural objects and traditional costumes handed down to them over the generations. Much of this has now been destroyed, according to Paul Marie, a cultural leader from the Mali ethnic group. Marie converted his lower village home into a cultural museum and school to teach young men and women songs and dances, as well as how to make handmade items and costumes used in the Mali culture. Speaking in Mali, Marie says he is struggling to reconstruct all of these items in the camp.
We have lost most of our cultural objects, musical instruments, including trumpets and drums, as well as traditional customs as a result of the war.
Marie says most refugee families eat one small meal a day, and that deprives youth of the energy they need to perform certain demanding tasks, including traditional dances.
Maintaining our cultural practices here particularly the traditional songs and dances, has been a real challenge. Every time we invite the youth to come for rehearsals, they say they are hungry. These activities need energy, and this means food.
Mari says he and other cultural leaders considered serving meals during rehearsals to persuade more people to attend cultural events, but there is no money to buy food. 25-year-old Stephen Duty, one of the few youth who signed up for dance lessons, says he is also learning how to make drums from timber and animal skin and how to play the drum. Speaking in Mali, Duty says it is a good idea to provide food during dance rehearsals.
We are
interested in learning more about our cultural heritage. But these activities cannot be done on empty stomachs. We have tried our best to persuade the youth to come. They tell us, yes, they are interested, but they need food.
Dichi says in his case, he is motivated by the need to preserve his people's cultural practices and make sure they are passed on to future generations.
The problem right now is that if our elders die without us learning something from them, we will have nothing to teach our children, and that will be a disaster.
Francis Eriga, another refugee at the Pagirinya camp, supports efforts to teach the younger generation about their culture. He says at the age of 29, he knows little about his culture because in the 1990s, he was raised in a refugee camp in Uganda.
And when I went back from Uganda to South Sudan, I was in the town. I did not get that chance. That's why I cannot perform, or I cannot dance.
Eriga says community leaders should create more opportunities for young men and women to learn and appreciate their culture. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Harami by CJ Orman. We have been listening to CJ Orman with the song Harami. I am John Tanza in Washington. Have a safe and peaceful weekend. Please join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
It's my destiny to die for the youth.
Mama katulu sangana maya.
They had a giserebu.
Baba katulu sanboda.
They had a giserebu.